Support for the Think Podcast comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering courses in art, literature, film, history, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. You can register online now for the upcoming fall programs at smu.edu/CAPE.
In December of 1952, a cloud filled with toxic gas descended on the city of London. It stank like rotten eggs, stained clothing worn outside, and was soon seeping through closed windows and chimney flues into homes and businesses. The most vulnerable 4,000 victims suffocated within days at home and in overwhelmed local hospitals, while twice that many died of complications in the weeks and months that followed. But amazingly, that contamination was less prominent in the headlines than reports of a murderer who was prowling London streets around the same time. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Kate Winkler-Dawson is a journalist and documentary producer who teaches journalism at the University of Texas at Austin. She tells the story of these deaths, a few at the hands of a sadistic criminal, thousands in the wake of an environmental disaster in her new book. It's called Death in the Air, the true story of a serial killer, the great London smog, and the strangling of a city. She joins us from the studios of KUT in Austin to talk about it. Kate, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me.
The number of deaths here was at least in the neighborhood of something like the Union Carbide gas leak in Bhopal in 1984. But I don't think nearly as many people know about what happened in London in 1952. Why have we forgotten?
Well, I think primarily because it happened in London. So a similar attack happened, if you want to call it an attack, in 1948 in Donora, Pennsylvania, and only about 20 people died. And there's an entire museum dedicated to those folks in Pennsylvania. And there's just nothing like that in London. It's just been a event that's been vanishing over the past decades. And it really only is revisited when there's a significant anniversary, the 50th anniversary, or for instance, this December is the 65th. So we'll probably see some articles pop up, but it was underreported then, and it continued to be underreported.
In order to understand this story, we have to understand what London was like in 1952, still trying to rebuild after all the damage done by air raids in the Second World War.
Yeah, and I think that that created an environment that was, I think, ripe for the government to be able to ignore pollution as a problem, which seems a little strange. But, you know, the British government was bankrupt after World War II. There were still the remnants of the buildings that had been bombed. They weren't able to rebuild. And I think it was just a city that was really struggling. The police force was underrepresented. There was a huge amount of crime. There were a lot of people who came home from the war angry, if they came home at all. And there was a lot of domestic violence, a lot of poverty, a lot of women who were left without husbands, without the fathers of their children. They had to turn to, you know, prostitution part-time or full-time. So there was a lot of despair. I mean, you know, with Queen Elizabeth II and her coronation approaching, the summer of 1953, there was a lot of hope, but it was still a city really struggling. And so this was an event that was not uncommon. The length of it was uncommon, but this, you know, anti-cyclone, which we can talk about later if you wish, that caused this smog was not uncommon. It usually would blow away within a day or two at the most. But, you know, really this was just treated as a really bad pea super, which is something that happened in London for, as we know, hundreds and thousands of years. That's what London was known for, was fog. So this was, and you know, with the people I interviewed in the book, this was something that was common. And, you know, they just moved past it because they were really literally a shell-shocked city. And they just had to, this was a stiff upper lip, move past it.
Okay, so one, you know, the British economy was still in shambles, but one way that they were able to profit was by mining and selling coal. But to maximize those profits, Kate, if I understand correctly, the best quality stuff was shipped abroad. So what was left for regular people to heat their homes in a city like London?
So, right, that's exactly what happened. So in order to climb out of this debt, the British government decided to export much of the what we would call, quote unquote, clean coal, which we know there's really no such thing as clean coal. So that was the black coal that had very high carbon content, which means when it burned smoke would you know, float up, obviously, and toxins would release. But it created heat like it was supposed to. So what Londoners were left with was brown coal, which they nicknamed Nutty Slack. And so brown coal was very low grade, very low carbon content, about a quarter of the heating value of black coal. So, you know, you would have to burn four times the amount a brown coal to get the same amount of heat you would get from burning high-quality, expensive black coal. So all coal was rationed, like sugar and butter and other things during the war and after the war. And when you burned this Nutty Slack, it was mostly dust and a little bit of coal nuggets. And when you burned it, it created a lot more smoke than clean coal would, and quite a lot more sulfur dioxide, which is the poison, one of the poisons, but the predominant poison that killed all these people. So about 4 days before the smog hit, the British government decided to lift the rationing on Nutty Slack. And when they lifted it, you know, that allowed people to go and buy as much as they wanted. So this happened on a Monday, and the smog hit really started to form on Friday. So you had people who were already burning their rations of Nutty Slack to begin with, but now they were able to burn as much as they wanted. There were some very cold days in December, and it created kind of this perfect storm that allowed for this smog to stick around for 5 days and kill thousands and thousands of people.
Okay, explain for us what an anticyclone is, this thing that you mentioned earlier. It sounds horrible, but counterintuitively, it was often a really good thing for winter weather in London.
Right. So it's a high-pressure system. They're very common. I mean, you know, we have them constantly all over the world. It's a high-pressure system. This one came from the Gulf Stream. And, you know, it floats over and it creates a lid over the city. You know, frequently, it sounds strange, but frequently it creates really nice weather, you know, clear blue skies, and it brings mild temperatures. But this one created, like I said, this perfect storm. So it was a high pressure system that had warm air flowed in, and it trapped the cold air. And this was a system that sat over London for 5 days. And so it was a lid, and any particles, anything in the air would be trapped. There was no wind, no breeze. And I think that the British Meteorological Office was just sort of praying that there was this little low pressure system that kept threatening to come in and blow out the high pressure system, and it just didn't happen. And when you have more than 8 million people burning low grade coal in their fireplaces, and then you have all these, you know, power plants and factories churning out smoke from and sulfur dioxide from low-grade coal on top of that, there's just sort of a perfect storm of pollution that can't go anywhere.
Yeah, so these combustion emissions are not just sitting there so people are breathing them in and out over and over. They're combining with one another, sometimes creating even more toxic byproducts. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So some of the strange things, coincidences, I suppose, that happened. So the London had a really extensive electric tram system that worked very well. But the government decided that they needed an upgrade and something that would be more efficient and, you know, be able to have more versatility. And so over the summer of 52, the British government retired their electric tram system and replaced it with those really wonderful double-decker red buses that are super flashy and run on diesel fuel. So the electric tram system went away, and in came all of these brand new buses that were churning out combustibles that came in the form of exhaust, carbon monoxide, carbon dioxide. And then we also had in 52 quite a lot of steam engines that ran on coal. And of course, you know, the boats, steamboats that ran on coal. So it was quite a lot of toxins in the air, which killed people and made people sick, and just on a daily basis. But during this storm and of this, I'm sorry, this anti-cyclone, it just really intensified, and it had nowhere to go. And so, you know, the descriptions from the people I've spoken with, and of course I've read, and the pictures and the video are yellow clouds, acrid smell, like rotten eggs. You can't see your feet. You can't see your hands. It's just, so for me, you know, we're both in Texas. I can only imagine it feels like being in a wildfire, which I've been in before. I've reported on wildfires in Northern California. And I know in Austin that when there's a wildfire in Bastrop, which is 30, 40 miles away, I can smell it in Austin. So I cannot imagine what it would be like to be in a space, a small city, which London is not a big city, a small city, and just trapped and to feel like, it must feel like drowning, like not being able to get away from it. It's in the walls, it's coming through the windows, it's in the hospitals, it's in the jails, it's everywhere. And so I think that feeling of sort of drowning is what I really was trying to get across in the book.
Well, you certainly did. I think for me, the image that really drove home how filthy this air was that, you know, the thought of walking through a cloud of fog and leaving it physically dirty is really disturbing. Like, you can imagine the air not being so pure, but you don't imagine that you will sort of see it on your clothes, how dirty this air was.
Well, and you know, it's funny, when I went to London to do research on one of the trips I went to, I spoke to a cab driver who, you know, is a present day cab driver. And he says the pollution there now is so horrible that his wife says you have to, he comes home from work, she said, you have to take a shower as soon as you get home. You can't take it in the morning, because when he would lay down on his white pillowcase, it would be black in the morning from all the grime and disgust.
Wow.
And so you can imagine, it was like tallow, it was grease, and it was, you know, it was nonstop grime. And yeah, I wouldn't think, you know, just breathing in air, you would leave behind all these particles, but you did. And so I think that they were very desperate. And of course, when the fog went away and everything sort of went back to, you know, an easy level of normality there. And then the following year, the government decided to issue these useless, what I found out to be, they were useless masks that they claimed were going to help people. And that didn't help people. You know, if you had a huge soot flake coming at you, then a mask, you know, would stop it. But it, nothing can stop, really, unless you wear a respirator. Nothing can stop sulfur dioxide, carbon monoxide, all of the poisons that were floating in the air. So, you know, this was a situation where the government eventually became so desperate that they were trying to show that they were searching for a solution, and they weren't coming up with the right solutions.
How did this smog event in late 1952 interrupt daily life in London? Like, if you can't even see your feet beneath you, did everybody stay home? Did people sort of feel their way around their neighborhoods?
I think it was a little both. Most people stayed home. You know, one of the threads that I have running through, one of the characters I have who is in this book is a police officer named Stanley Crichton. Yeah. And he really, he said, you know, he would, his beat was in North London and Holloway Road. And you expect it to be packed on a Saturday, which, you know, the fog started on a Friday and kind of continued through Monday and Tuesday. And he said the streets were empty. I mean, there was no one there. But, you know, there were people who ventured out. We'll talk about my serial killer, I'm assuming, later on. And he was one of the people who ventured out. But the city just started to go on lockdown. They tried to continue the tube system. It soon became very clear that the bus system was not going to work anymore. So that, you know, this was a breakdown of the transportation system, which is really what hampered the city, and it just convinced people to stay home.
My guest is Kate Winkler Dawson. She teaches journalism at the University of Texas, and she's author of a new book called Death in the Air: The True Story of a Serial Killer, the Great London Smog, and the Strangling of a City. We will get to that serial killer in just a couple of minutes. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 to ask questions, or you can find us on Twitter. We're at KERA Think.
Support for the Think Podcast comes from the SMU Doctor of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening doctoral program where you can distinguish yourself personally and professionally. More at smu.edu/DLS.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with journalist and documentary producer Kate Winkler Dawson. She teaches at UT. Her new book is called Death in the Air: The True Story of a Serial Killer, the Great London Smog, and the Strangling of a City. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. So, Kate, we'll put a pin in the smog that is choking and trapping people all over London. There's this weirdly parallel story of another killer. This one was human. Who was John Reginald Christie?
He was a quiet, unassuming man.
They always are.
Aren't they always? Yes, awkward. He was sort of your neighborhood creep in a way. He was a government worker. He worked for a transport office, British Transport Office. Sort of your average guy. He was married, no children, and he and his wife lived in a flat in Notting Hill, and it's a very famous address now, 10 Rillington Place. And it's hard to believe this, but Notting Hill in the 50s was a ghetto. It was a horrible place. I mean, it really, the crime was incredible, and, you know, a lot of prostitution and gambling and gangs. And so, you know, this sort of average guy was an upstanding citizen in this area. He and his wife were very quiet. He kept a garden in the back of his tenement building, and he just sort of went about his work. I think when you dig deeper into his personality, before he became this now infamous in London serial killer, you know, he grew up in England, in a suburb of London, and he had what I would say would be some sort of pivotal moments that shaped his character, unfortunately. He had an overbearing mother, numerous sisters who were very overbearing. He had a moderately abusive father, and he had some pretty big embarrassments in his teenage years with girls, where he was publicly humiliated, and then he was in World War One. And he was gassed with mustard gas, and he lost part of his voice. And he just was a very awkward man. He had a very large forehead. He had kind of an effeminate voice. He had a little girlish bounce. And I think he had an awful lot of self-esteem issues that ended up coming out when he would attack women. So he's a really, as so I consider myself sort of aficionado with serial killers, as a serial killer, I'm not surprised at all by his background, but I think that his methods were certainly interesting, and we can certainly talk about that.
How did he discover that he got this thrill from killing?
Well, it's interesting. So he says he gave several confessions, and then he sold his story to the Sunday Pictorial newspaper, which is a really interesting aspect of journalism in 1950s London. But he sold his story, and so, you know, there's an awful lot of stories out of John Christie where he says, you know, he really does some explaining. And he says that he was fascinated seeing the body of his grandfather after his grandfather died, and he just sort of became fixated on the beauty of a dead body. And so he had numerous affairs on his wife, and he hired prostitutes, and Ethel would frequently visit her sister away from London, and so he would have the flat to himself. And so in the early 40s, he brought a woman home, and they had sex, and he killed her. It was, I believe it was a spur of the moment. It wasn't sort of this, you know, plotted out first degree murder. I think it was a spur of the moment. And that's when he really realized that he enjoyed the power. I think because he lacked power his whole life. He lacked power. He was made fun of, And he always felt like women were disingenuous with him. And so I think this was his way of taking control back.
It's not remotely funny, and I want to make sure that people know this, but it is bizarre how many times Christie was close to being caught and almost by accident managed to avoid somebody realizing there was a body buried like 6 inches beneath their feet or, you know, a foot from where they were standing in the garden.
It is a little Keystone Cops with the scenario. And you know, the best example I can give is when, you know, Christie had two women buried in the back garden, and his, what I think is a very important part of the story is when his neighbor, Timothy Evans, and his family moved into 10 Rillington Place, which was in, you know, 1949, after these two women had been buried in Christie's backyard for several years. A young family moved in, a husband, a wife, and a little girl, 14-month-old girl, and the wife and the little girl went missing. And Timothy Evans, the husband, confessed, and then he recanted and said, my neighbor John Christie did it. But John Christie was a war reserve policeman. He was this upstanding citizen. He didn't have a serious police record, and so no one believed him. So, you know, we can get into that case a little bit later, but when the Metropolitan Police, the Notting Hill Division, went looking for Burl and Geraldine Evans, the wife and the little girl of this man, Tim Evans. They went through Christie's garden, and, you know, this man had taken one of the women he had buried in the backyard, her thigh bone, and used the thigh bone to prop up a part of his fence that was falling down. And they walked right past it. I mean, I just can't. Can you imagine? But, you know, in their defense, his backyard was horrible. I mean, there was trash everywhere, and they were, you know, incredibly focused on finding this woman and the little girl. And then they never looked in the wash house where their bodies had been. So, you know, you're right. There were an awful lot of missed clues here. But I think that that also is part of how undermanned the police were in 1952 and in 1950 and 51 and 52. It was, you know, they were solving twice as many cases as they had, you know, right after the war, but with half as many police officers. So, but that's no excuse for walking past a femur.
So you do a really good job of detailing what turns out to be a super complicated and convoluted story with Tim Evans and what happened to his wife and daughter, and pregnant wife, we should say, and the murders that Christie was committing on single women often who came to visit him. But I want to... A lot of people think that Tim Evans ultimately was executed wrongfully. What did you discover about what Christie might have had to do with those two other murders?
So in London, in any sort of media that's been done about Timothy Evans, he is the poster boy for the wrongfully executed. I mean, everywhere. So this all comes from... My interest in this comes from my father, who was a law professor at the University of Texas Law School for 37 years, and he started the Actual Innocence Clinic there. So, you know, he and I would talk about these types of cases, and, you know, after he died, I ended up working with them quite a bit and, you know, co-teaching some classes. So, you know, innocence is a passion of mine. So when I saw this case, I thought, well, this is perfect. You know, I went into it incorrectly, which is assuming... what everybody else assumed, which is that Timothy Evans was innocent. So let me explain the background. So Timothy Evans confessed and then recanted and then confessed again and then recanted. It just went on and on. He was an abusive husband, and all of the evidence showed that he snapped. He killed Burl, his wife, and then strangled his daughter. So John Christie testified against him. Nobody knew there were two women buried in the back of his yard at the time. No one knew he was a serial killer. He testified against Timothy Evans. Timothy Evans said, no, John Christie did it. So Timothy Evans was ultimately hanged, and it was sort of a closed case. One of the journalists there called it a fish and chippy case, you know, a husband snaps and that's the end of it. It was sort of a non-news story. It wasn't this huge salacious story. So flash forward to 1952, and, you know, 3 or 4 days after the smog, Christie kills his wife, Ethel, and buries her under the floorboards of their parlor, and then he goes on a short killing spree and kills three more women in January and in March, and he goes on the run. So one of the, that's sort of the climax of the story, is that he's on the run and all of these headlines come out, murder house and, you know, bodies being pulled out, and the Metropolitan Police put it together really quickly, which is serial killer at 10 Rillington Place. What are the chances that there are two killers living there at the same time? And the newspaper said they got the wrong guy. We have Timothy Evans, who was hanged, and he shouldn't have been, and we shouldn't have trusted John Christie. And then eventually John Christie confessed to killing Burl and Geraldine. So I don't believe him, John Reginald Christie, at all. I think that, again, I think that the kind of the collective wisdom here and collective knowledge is that this was a wrongful execution, but there are so many wrong things with this. There were, you know, none of this added up. This case didn't add up to John Christie killing a little girl, which he never had any kind of issue with children. He's never been abusive towards children. He would have no motive to kill a little girl. And, you know, there were some missteps with the wife. You know, Christie typically sexually assaulted women and then killed him. And there was no evidence that Burl Evans was sexually assaulted. His confession made no sense. And a lawyer eventually admitted that he told Christie to basically confess to every crime under the sun because they were hoping to have a insanity defense so that he wouldn't be hanged. So there's a lot more information than just, you know, hey, there's a serial killer. How could a serial killer and another killer live under the same roof? But my feeling after doing all of this research on post-war London was that you have a serial killer in a building, and then you have a wife beater who snapped and killed his wife and his daughter. And to me, that's absolutely plausible. Absolutely. There were so many abusive men in London at the time, particularly those who served in World War II. And it just wouldn't have surprised me a bit. Not at all.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Kate Winkler Dawson. We're talking about her new book, Death in the Air, the true story of a serial killer, the great London smog, and the strangling of a city. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. Kate, what is at those addresses next door to one another today? Are the buildings still standing? Is there like a Starbucks? What's there?
They demolished the whole block. Mm. They got rid of the whole block. It's now a place called Ruston Close, which is a jiggy-jog street that doesn't even fit there anymore. But the residents were essentially driven out within a few years. Nobody wanted to live in the murder house to begin with. There were death threats, and it became this infamous street, and they eventually got rid of it. And yes, it's very likely there's a Starbucks there. It's such a nice, posh area. Now it's just so hard to believe that it was such a sort of dilapidated, falling apart neighborhood.
So here's the weird thing. There are people who remember this bizarre murder case. It was absolutely covered in all the papers, and it pushed to the back pages stories of hospitals like literally overrun with people choking to death.
Right. And I think that is a case of it's easier to be fascinated with, you know, a man on the run who's a serial killer. It's a salacious story. It's a clear and present danger versus really focusing in on something that requires a systemic change, which is air pollution, certainly. It's just a sexier story. He really marked the beginning of, I think, in the 1950s, of the celebrity criminal, the celebrity killer in London. And, you know, this is the reason that this story with Christie even came about was, you know, I had no intentions of including him in a book. I had no idea who he was. I spent probably about 6 months searching for characters, and I had settled on Norman Dodds, who was the politician in the book who really championed clean air and took on Churchill's government. And I went through the New York Times archives for 1953 and the London Times archives, and I was looking for smog news. And it became pretty clear that there was very little smog news because it was such an underreported story. Even when the Minister of Health started revealing in January how many people died per week, and it was 1,500 one week and 2,200 the next week, there's still no major news stories. So about March, when I got to the March archives, I see dozens of headlines of murder house and killer on the run and moonstruck murderer. And I mean, just these incredible headlines that seem like National Enquirer headlines now. And it was really frustrating because I was getting bogged down with these headlines and I couldn't get to the fog, and the fogs were just, you know, these fog headlines were little blips on the back pages. And that's when I really started to make the connection. And to me, sort of, where we are in news cycles now, it really reminds me of what happened in the 50s. You have politicians now making really outlandish statements that make headlines, and what I consider the real news stories are buried. Mm-hmm. And you have these, bombastic statements that make headlines and derail the conversations that we really should be having. And that's exactly what happened. I mean, Christie certainly was not the only major headline, but he really did lead the papers from, I would say, March of 53 through his execution. And then it kept going because there was a huge debate over, Timothy Evans, and should he be posthumously exonerated? And, you know, and so it just kept going on, and the fog story just disappeared.
If I were a physician or somebody who worked in an emergency room and a bunch of people came in all of a sudden with respiratory distress, my assumption would be that they had some kind of common infection. How did doctors figure out right away that wasn't the case?
You know, the doctor, Dr. Atkinson, who is the one who I profiled in the book, he described listening to the chest of several patients, and there was a rattle there that wouldn't have been there had it been an infection. And there was plenty of bronchitis. You know, one of the characters in my book is a 13-year-old girl whose father had bronchitis every winter. And I think that that sort of diagnosis was very clear at the beginning. But what could doctors do at that point except try to save people?
My guest is journalist Kate Winkler-Dawson, who teaches at the University of Texas at Austin. Her new book is called Death in the Air: The True Story of a Serial Killer, the Great London Smog, and the Strangling of a City. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or go to Twitter. We are @KERAThink.
Support for the Think podcast comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening master's program for working professionals. You can apply now for the fall of 2017. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with documentary producer and journalist Kate Winkler-Dawson, who teaches at UT and is author of a new book called Death in the Air: The True Story of a Serial Killer, the Great London Smog, and the Strangling of a City. You can join us by emailing think@kera.org, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. Okay, you mentioned before the break Rosemary Sargent. Her father, Albert, as you said, had, you know, sort of what probably would have been called weak lungs at the time. He would get a lot of chest infections, but he had to walk home from work the first day that this smog rolled in. By the time he got home, he could barely breathe. And the way you describe, you know, the smog sort of oozing in through cracks around windows and doors, it's almost like this was, you know, some kind of insidious stalker, this pollution.
Absolutely. And that's the way Rosemary described it. She was wonderful to interview. She was really descriptive. And I think that it was so vivid in her mind. She never really talked about it very much publicly, but she described it as rolling through windows. So you would think running into your house and shutting the door would keep you safe. But you have to also think post-war London, a lot of these houses are not very well built. And, you know, she was not in a affluent area. So you had a lot of seepage seeping through the windows, through, you know, broken window panes. And so it really does feel like that. And the doctors described the looks on people's faces when they would see the smoke and the fog coming in when they were being treated like rabid animals coming after them. So I really feel like it doesn't seem like it would be harmful necessarily. I mean, who hasn't sat too closely to a campfire? But if you can imagine breathing that in for 5 days, then it would be terrifying.
There were all kinds of people who had relatives, you know, who were vulnerable to respiratory distress and had to leave them behind to go out and work.
Right. And that's what's so interesting is, you know, the transportation shut down probably by about late Saturday, early Sunday in London. But people still worked, and frequently Albert worked on Saturdays. So frequently people worked 5.5, 6 day weeks. Of course, many people work 7 days a week, but it wasn't uncommon for most people to work, to leave and to go out. And my one of my characters, Stanley, who was the police officer, had to leave his wife. He was a 19-year-old sort of fledgling police officer who had to go out and patrol the streets by himself. And his wife was a nurse, and she had severe asthma and couldn't breathe. And she wanted to report to duty at the hospital, and he wouldn't let her. And right, it really, you just had to sort of push on. So, and also another note that sort of added to the distress that people felt is there was a very large part of the population. What I've read is up to 80% of people in London smoked, which doesn't help, including Rosemary's father. I mean, she talks about going out and getting him a pack of cigarettes. So you're at a disadvantage. So many of the people who died were the older folks, the pensioners. And, you know, one of the memos that I pulled from, of the thousands of memos that I looked through for this book, was a memo filed under the Ministry of Health, in which a doctor said these were people who were going to die anyway, most of them, because they were elderly and they were of poor health.
What were the long-term ramifications? Like, at what point did people say, we cannot let this happen again? Because legislation was passed that at least helped London and the rest of Britain turn the corner with its air pollution.
Right. And, you know, there is, to me, no defense for necessarily for the British government. But this was also a government who was bankrupt, and smokeless fuel, switching over to oil and gas and electricity was just not financially feasible. It slowly, mostly, I think, from the help of Norman Dodds, slowly the Labour Party sort of solidified and got behind the idea that something needed to change. And then many of the members of the Conservative government also did. But, you know, the fog happened in 1952, and the Clean Air Act of 1956 was 4 years later. That's an awful long time to go without having some major changes. So as the next winter approached, around about November of 1953, people sort of braced for another smog. There wouldn't be another smog ever of this magnitude, I think partially because immediately the government became sort of more wary of having lawsuits and more deaths and bad press. And so they started to scale back or try to scale back as much as they could. You know, the power plants and industry, which was, you know, couldn't do very much over a 9-month period before the next smog. They issued these masks that I talked about earlier, which were useless, and they charged a prescription fee for them. And I think that the government just really hoped this was going to go away. And the Churchill's cabinet created a committee led by Hugh Beaver, who investigated different solutions. And he came back with a fairly comprehensive report that was a report that could be held up by the Conservatives' opponents in Parliament and said, this is what we have to do. It created smokeless zones. It was a rollout of banning coal in London. So it was not the perfect legislation, but it was certainly a blueprint for other countries to follow, including the United States, which we didn't have our own Clean Air Act until 14 years later.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak on the phone now with Julianne in Dallas. Hi, Julianne.
Hi, it's Julianne, actually.
Julianne, oh, hi.
It's okay. I was in one of those smogs, and I was going to an audition for an acting school. I was about 17, and you literally couldn't see your hand in front of your face. You couldn't see the curb. It was like choking yellow, like fumes. It was just horrible. I was just there for that one day, but my throat was like sore for days after from breathing that stuff.
That sounds really awful. Anyway. I'm glad you made it out, but thank you very much for sharing. I really appreciate it, Jillian.
Oh, you're welcome.
I guess people who were there remember it. They just don't remember it being a big news story, Kate?
Yeah. It wasn't for quite a long time. And it was the florists and the morticians who realized first that there was a problem, not even the government and not even the individual hospitals. I mean, I think each hospital knew that they had received an influx of patients, but there wasn't a computer system where they could see, you know, the numbers from the amount of patients each one took in. And so the florists and the morticians realized they were running out of flowers and running out of space. Hmm. And they're the ones who really sent the red flag to begin with. And I'll tell you one other thing that's interesting is a lot of people I meet have never heard of this until they saw The Crown, which was on Netflix. And it was on episode 4 of The Crown where they featured the smog. And virtually every aspect of that show was a fabrication. It was Churchill almost lost, you know, Parliament, and he was going to resign, and Labour was up in arms. It was a very dramatic interpretation of what happened. The BBC is on the radio saying people are outraged, and just none of that happened. No one was outraged, even when 4,000 people dead came out. No one was outraged. It just slowly went away.
Hmm. That's got to be frustrating because so many people do, without necessarily meaning to do so, they end up taking their history from fictionalized accounts of things.
It is, and I think it's dangerous because you are left with the assumption that people in London in the 1950s cared more deeply about the environment than they did. And I think that that's too bad because it is reimagining history and certainly giving the Labour Party a lot more credit than it deserved. So I think that, I understand why it was done. And on one hand, I think, when I finished the episode, I thought, well, you know, it looked the part. It looked right. But I also have to be grateful that people even know about it, that this happened, and they should know about it. And it's incredible that most people don't know. 12,000 people dead is a lot. And to know that there's just no remembrance for it is very sad for me.
How long did it take to get a number like 12,000? Because that wasn't, you know, maybe if that had been the headline 3 months later, people would have paid attention.
Well, 4,000 seemed like a large headline to me, but you're right, 12,000. So what happened with that number is the government kept moving the cutoff date for how many people died, you know, from the quote-unquote smog deaths. So they said, well, take the amount of people who were hospitalized and died from respiratory or heart issues all the way through December 31st, and the fog ended about December 10th or so, take that number. And that was 4,000. And the issue is between January and March, an additional 8,000 people died. And it clearly was linked to, you know, the smog. You're not going to have people drop dead immediately. I mean, sometimes they linger. And this was clearly indicated on a chart that the government itself, you know, distributed. And then the chart was altered to say 8,000 influenza deaths, and there was never an epidemic during that time period. So some researchers, probably about 15 years ago, ended up doing some biopsies on the lungs of some of the victims and really did some incredible analysis and discovered that, you know, these were, in fact, it was 12,000 deaths that you could clearly attribute to the fog. And there are Stanley, you know, the police officer said he knows his wife, Maura, died probably 10 or 15 years earlier than she should have because her asthma was uncontrollable after that. So, you know, there are people who live with the result of what happened with that fog for the rest of their lives.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Next on the phone to Jane in Bay City. Hi, Jane.
Hi. I've been listening to your talk, and it's very interesting. I was born during World War II, and I lived in the States, but I've read quite a bit about London and England. One thing that I think would be relevant to mention is that they used a lot of coal to heat their homes and probably their cook stoves, whatever, their fireplaces.
Yeah, thank you, Jane. As you mentioned earlier, coal was pretty much the fuel, right, at home for folks, Kate.
Right, exactly. It was. And it was the only thing they could afford at the time.
Yeah. As a journalist, what is your most important takeaway from stories like these, this environmental disaster that gets overlooked and just not challenged when it was inaccurately reported by the government, and then kind of a lurid, you know, a murder is a big deal, but it doesn't, once the murderer has been caught, it doesn't affect other people. What should we take away from this with regard to the way we relate to news stories today?
Well, I mean, it's difficult because, you know, being a member of the media, I certainly respect this industry. I love being a journalist, but I certainly think that we are very easily misdirected and derailed, depending on who the newsmakers are. And I think that, you know, as a public and you know, as members of the press, we certainly need to not lose focus, particularly when, you know, we are in an environment now where the press is constantly challenged by, you know, both parties. And, you know, and I think that we have to decide what's important, and we are being constantly distracted by other issues, just like they were in the 50s. And I think that just because there's not explosions or this, you know, language, this aggressive language, or if it's not a sexy story, doesn't mean it's not important. I think it's always going to be the case that these stories are going to be underreported. But I really hope that this is a situation that people will remember. That amount of people is incredible, and that we can't take our air for granted or our environment for granted. And I think that it's important to really kind of stand up and demand, if the press won't give those issues coverage, we have to demand it. And I'm not sure we are demanding it.
Kate Winkler-Dawson is a journalist and a documentary filmmaker who teaches journalism at the University of Texas at Austin. We've talked this hour about her new book, which is called Death in the Air: The True Story of a Serial Killer, the Great London Smog, and the Strangling of a City. Kate, it's been a really interesting conversation. Thank you very much for making time for us.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Shelley Canavy is our technical director. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. And Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can follow us on Facebook and also on Twitter. The Twitter handle is @KERAThink. My personal Twitter handle is @ChrisBoydThink. You can subscribe to the podcast anywhere you find podcasts. You can also find it at think.kera.org, where there's lots of information about the staff and about upcoming shows. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.